Hello, friends. Thank you so much for joining us for the first ever What Page Are You On live event. This is my co-host. Who is it?
Alice Slater.
And we are so honoured and excited to be joined by Lucy McKnight Hardy, who wrote Water Shall Refuse Them. Please introduce yourself.
To repeat what you've just said, I'm Lucy McKnight Hardy. I've just come over this evening to have a little chat about my book, to answer some questions, if anyone has some, and to have a bit of a chat and do some signings a bit later.
Cool. So would you like to tell our good friends here how we think things are going to pan out?
Okay, so we're going to start with a quick reading from Lucy to introduce you to the book. We're then going to do about a 20-minute Q&A with Bethany and I, and then we will turn to you guys for some questions from the audience. Lucy, are you ready to go?
Yeah, of course.
Dive right in.
I'm going to read a section from quite close to the beginning of the book. It comes after Niff and her family, so that's her younger brother, Laurie, and her mother, Linda, and her father, Clive, have gone to stay at a borrowed cottage in a village on the borders of Wales in order to recover from the death of Laurie's twin sister, Petra. And so the beginning of the book deals with them arriving in the village, and this now is when they picks up the next morning, so that their first morning in the village. The rusting gate squealed when I pulled it open, and I winced, waiting for something to happen. Nothing. There was no one on the lane, and the dust lay still. From the verge on the opposite side, a couple of rabbits lolloped out. They were leaner, rangier than the ones I'd seen in the park at home, and they hopped closer, within a couple of feet of me. I remembered my dad telling me that the heat wave had caused a lot of animals to change their behaviour, that they had to adapt to an environment where there was very little water, and that they took greater risks around human beings because they were thirsty. I went down on my haunches and held out a hand to them, encouraging them to come to me. They just looked at me glassily, so I kicked out at them, and they scampered back into the hedge next to the little cottage on the other side of the lane. It was set back from the road, with nothing but a patch of scorched grass and a dilapidated wooden fence in front of it. The two houses mirrored each other, as though they were whispering together in collusion against the chapel. All the curtains were closed, except for those at the little attic window. The chapel was painted a dirty white, and a coppery discharge was weeping from the walls. The windows reflected the morning sunlight, blank as cataracts. The gates were still padlocked shut, and there was a fence running along either side, black painted railings with curling, fleur-de-lis spikes across the top. I wanted to see the war memorial in daylight, where I'd seen the girls the night before. The cows in the field stared at me with insolent indifference as I walked along the lane. There were half a dozen or so of the scraggy creatures, and they were suffering from the heat. Emaciated, their ribs bulged rudely through the sandpaper-like skin on their flanks. Their tails twitched at the flies that clustered around them and which settled on the rims of their eyes and the pale flesh of their noses. Pathetic animals. I came to a little bridge that I hadn't noticed the night before. There was a low stone wall that ran along the side of the lane where it crossed the stream that only came up as far as my thighs. I leant over to inspect the brown water below. There was barely any left, maybe a couple of feet. Further down the stream, where it dragged itself along the valley, a tree trunk swelled out, hanging over the water. There the stream looked deeper, welcoming, somewhere to bring Laurie later to get him washed. I looked around to see how we would be able to get down there, and I spotted a gate which I thought might open into the fields that banked the stream. That would do. Sweat was already starting to prickle on my back. I would need a wash later too. The war memorial stood erect but sullen in the middle of a patch of faded grass, facing me as soon as I turned a bend in the lane. It was supported by a stone plinth, and the steps around the base were littered with empty lager cans and cigarette ends. I looked to see if anything could be salvaged. There were a few fag ends that could be reused, so I pocketed them. That was when I noticed the dips all around the base of the war memorial, little concave holes that were about 2 inches wide and regularly spaced. The stone the monument had been carved from was darker than that used for the houses in the village. It was the same grey mottled stone, but it looked more worn and older, as if it had been standing there forever. Looking up, I saw that instead of forming a pyramid-shaped peak at the top, or a sharp-pointed cross like all the other war memorials I had seen, this one ended in a small, delicate cross, curled at the three ends like the ace of clubs. The stone was battered and had obviously been eroded over time, and it looked as if it might crumble away at any moment. It looked older than it was possible for a war memorial to be. I placed the tips of my fingers in one of the little dips at the base of the monument, and the stone felt smooth against my skin. In the corner of my eye, there was a flash of movement, and I heard a clicking sound. I jerked around, expecting to see someone. Nothing, only the relentless stillness and the flat colours of a depleted landscape. Already I could see the familiar shimmer of heat that rose from the lane, making the grass verge tremble and threaten to disappear. Time to head back. We cooked bacon for breakfast on the little camping stove we'd brought with us and ate it sitting around the kitchen table. We drank tea and nobody said very much. My mother came down while we were eating, her dressing gown wrapped tightly around her and held closed against her throat. Her hair was pulled up tightly into her usual bun, and I thought about how she'd looked the night before when we'd sat at this table and she'd drunk red wine and talked about Petra and she'd looked 10 years younger. Now she looked ancient. She toyed with the bacon rinds on her plate, pushing them round with her fork, worms in grease. After breakfast, I took Laurie outside and we lay on the patch of concrete at the front of the house. It was covered in a web of cracks and frail tufts of dandelions sprouted half-heartedly here and there, the petals wilted and thin. I pulled them up in tufts and threw them onto the scorched grass. I watched as Laurie picked his nose, as he eased out the thick gobbets of dust and snot that accumulated there before depositing them in his mouth. Occasionally a red ant would scurry past, sometimes carrying a trophy above its head, and I'd use my thumb to grind it into the concrete, causing a pathetic smear of rusty brown to appear against the grey. The heat wave instilled a lethargy in us that was difficult to shake off. We lay torpid in the sun, limbs stretched, lizards soaking up the heat. Laurie's face was turned up to the sun, his eyes closed. He hadn't said very much that morning, but that wasn't unusual. He only really talked to say what he needed, to ask for food and water and the other things that had to be done for him to keep him alive. His hair curled against the grass, the soft blonde strands mingling with the starchy yellow hay that encroached onto the edge of the concrete from the lawn around it. I lay flat on my belly, enjoying the mid-morning warmth on my back, and put my chin on my arm. A grasshopper landed on the concrete in front of me, an inch of green-brown legs and torso. Its feelers twitched, and I waited for it to start clicking, anticipating it rubbing its legs together and calling out for a mate, but it stayed silent. I put a hand out to it, but before I could grab it, it hopped away. It was still early enough for the sun to be quite benign. I turned over onto my back and closed my eyes. An imprint of a bright circle remained in my vision, and little lights danced, bright green against orange. I knew that when I opened my eyes, they would still be there for a few moments, temporarily scorched onto my retinas. To my left, the grasshopper started to make its rasping sound, and I turned my head and eased my eyes open, cautious of the sun's glare. The sound stopped abruptly, and I couldn't see the insect at all. As my eyes adjusted back to the brightness, my focus shifted, and I spotted something glinting on the railings at the front of the parking area, suspended and skewered by the spike at the top of one post, something gleaming white. I lay very still and looked at it. It hadn't been there when I'd got back from my walk earlier that morning. I pushed myself to my feet, all the time looking at the object, afraid that it might disappear if I let it out of my sight. I never once took my eyes off it as I walked towards it, climbed the steps and squeaked open the little gate. Only when I was within a couple of feet of it could I see what it was. It was a skull, a bird skull with a sharp, shiny black beak protruding from the bone. It had been placed on the post so that the spike pierced one of the eye sockets, the skull tilted in an absurd expression of confusion. I lifted it carefully off the fence. The surface was scattered with hairline cracks, tiny fissures that spread in a web over the cranium. The pearly white bone held eye sockets that were dark and empty. The skull fitted comfortably into the curve of my palm, but the beak was heavier than the bone and it tipped forward, the sharp end pressing into the soft flesh of my fingertip. I bent to it and breathed in deeply. At first I thought it had no smell at all, but then I caught the suggestion of something warm and dark and earthy. In my mind I recited the incantation. Robin's egg, magpie's egg, duckling bill and bone, blackbird's egg, feathers of wren. I felt sure that the bird's skull was the final relic, the one that would complete the incantation. I left Laurie lying there in the sun and ran up both flights of stairs to my bedroom. I placed the skull on the end of the mantelpiece next to the other relics. It fitted perfectly.
Thank you so much for that.
What a treat.
Thank you.
So for the benefit of our listeners at home, I'm going to, as we do on the pod, just nutshell the book for us.
Because I assume people who are here know the nature of this event, which is that you are here, but it is also a live recording of a podcast, which people will be listening to who are not you. So hopefully you know what this book is, but there may be people listening at home who are not familiar with the plot. So Alice is going to do the honours.
So 16-year-old Nif and her family retreat to a small village in the wake of her little sister's death. But Nif brings with her the talismans of her own burgeoning witchcraft. Grief, guilt, and secrets ramp up the tension in this coming-of-age suspense that sits right at home between Andrew Michael Hurley and Shirley Jackson.
Wow.
Yeah. If you're going to get compared to something, it might as well be those two.
Yeah, that suits me very well. Thank you.
Would you like to kick us off with a question, Alice?
Yeah, so I'd like to know, where did the spark of this book come from?
Okay. The germ of the idea, the spark, came from an email from my mum a few years ago. And it said, basically it said, ha ha, you'll love this. And it was a link to a newspaper article, which was a report about, just to put some context to this, my parents and my sister and I moved to this tiny village in rural West Wales when I was two. And we lived in the house next to the chapel. So I grew up in this house next to the chapel, and even though we weren't chapel goers, we saw all the to-ing and fro-ing that went on with it. So the newspaper report was about the minister at the chapel who'd just written his autobiography, because as a sideline, he was a minor celebrity with an antiques programme on Welsh TV. That's irrelevant, don't need to know that. Okay.
Name-dropping there.
But, so in this newspaper article was about how he claimed in his autobiography that he had been called out on several occasions to the villages surrounding the area where I grew up to perform exorcisms, and that witchcraft was being practiced actively in the area where I'd grown up. And I thought, wow, you know.
Correct.
Yeah.
Because we tend to think of witchcraft as being a historical thing, but I thought, well, how about if this is happening in a more up-to-date setting? So that was the spark for me.
Thanks, Mom.
Yeah.
So it's set in a very specific summer in the 1970s.
That's right.
Do you feel like it had to be set then, or was that just what you were feeling, or was there, what was the kind of thinking behind the time period?
I wanted it to be set during a heat wave. I came at that because I have quite an antagonistic personality. My husband's at the back there nodding furiously. And so my take on it was, why approach something from the traditional perspective? Why go at a horror story or a ghost story with a big old haunted house and a dark and windy moor
in
the depths of winter? And I thought, so turn that on its head and approach it from the point of view of a heat wave, which is just as oppressive but in a different way. So it's an environment that puts pressure on the characters. They can't change the environment. They can't leave. They can't get out of it. And if you put pressure on your characters, they start to do interesting things. So that was my thinking behind that. And so 1976, obviously, that was the last real heat wave. I mean, they're becoming increasingly frequent since then. But that was the one that struck me as being an interesting one. For me, it's within living memory. For a lot of people my generation, we kind of still have a few memories of it. And I think for younger generations, it's quite evocative of what we're going through now with increasing heat waves. So it just seemed obvious, really.
Yeah. And would you say that writing in that kind of oppressive atmosphere of a heat wave affected your writing style?
I think it became more intense. I think the description of place and atmosphere is quite important to the book. I think the place itself is almost like one of the characters. It's really important that that's how the characters interact with each other, is through their environment, through this little village and the environmental circumstances. So, yeah, I think my writing style did become more location-specific.
And what had you written before this? So this is your kind of debut novel.
Yeah.
What's your, like, writing history?
Not a lot, to be honest. I wrote this as my dissertation for an MA in creative writing. Before that, I'd written a few short stories as part of that course. And I did an OU module on creative writing, so I produced a few things for that. But before then, my history's really in marketing and PR and advertising. So it's writing press releases, marketing copy. So it's always been writing related, but not fiction.
It's a very impressive way to begin your writing life.
Thank you.
Congrats.
Thank you.
And what's your experience been with Dead Ink?
It's been great. Obviously, if people don't know, they're a very small independent publisher based in Liverpool. A lot of debut authors tend to try and go through the literary agent route and then get in with one of the big five publishers and their imprints. I was actually drawn to Dead Ink because their slogan is publishing the underground, so they like to take risks with new authors. They're very, very passionate, very driven. It's been great.
And you have really, like, popped off for them. What happened today? What did we learn today?
We've learned that we've had a sellout.
This is, yeah.
Going for a reprint.
This is getting reprinted, which is so cool. Like, you know, I think it's a very, like, symbiotic relationship with, like, a small press. Like, what can your publisher do for you and what can you do
Absolutely.
For your publisher? And it's such
yeah.
a, yeah. It feels like this has been such an amazing fit. And I just remember as soon as... We didn't even know what the book was about, really, did we? Like, you just saw the cover and saw the name and you were like, one for the pod.
I'm a very instinctive reader, you know?
You know what we like.
I got very lucky with that cover. I mean, the cover is just perfect.
I actually did want to talk to you about the cover. Tell us the story behind the cover.
We love covers and we have no shame about it. We judge books by covers all the time.
It's actually a very, very simple story. Dead Ink gave me a questionnaire asking what I did and didn't like on covers. Which they then sent to the cover designer. I was absolutely bowled over them, and they told me that that was Luke Bird, who is just phenomenal. And he sent back three options on the cover. This was one of them, and that's the one I liked most. There's been very few tweaks since then, so it was just a kind of meeting of minds. Really, really fortunate.
Yeah, I love it. And if I hadn't seen the cover having a quote from Andrew Michael Hurley, one of the books it would have reminded me of anyway would have been Baloney.
Right, yeah.
Is that a book that you liked already?
It was an absolute godsend to me, the Baloney. It came at a point, it was published at a point when I was writing Water and I was a bit stuck. And the Baloney came out and the tone that is used, that Andrew Michael Hurley establishes, and the setting, the location, even though it's very different to mine, it's set up in the northwest, and it is one of these dank environments, but just the descriptions, it just came at a perfect time, and it gave me that little bit of a boost to think about the narrator's voice and how important that is to
a book.
How
they kind of relate to the world, and how they learn things and interact. Yeah, they're both really different from each other, but have, if you like one, you'll probably like the other.
I hope so, yeah.
I love Baloney, and I love this.
Is it embarrassing if I read what Andrew Michael Hurley said about the book?
Never.
So he said, a coming-of-age story where the threat of violence shimmers like a heat haze, which I think is just perf. You must have cried with happiness.
I couldn't have written that better myself, honestly. If someone had said, give us a quote that we can attribute to Andrew Michael Hurley, I couldn't have come up with that. So
did you write it yourself?
No.
Um, what kind of, so we've got Lalonie, is there anything else that you feel is kind of in this book that you felt?
What I'm really pleased about is that quite a few people have said it reminds them of the Wasp Factory.
Very much so.
You said that to me and I said I haven't read it, but I've read the Wikipedia entry because I'm too scared of reading the book.
Famously, Bethany will not read the Wasp Factory. So in a way, this has got you off the hook because otherwise I would have put this book with the Wasp Factory.
Yeah. It's
I think it's going to stress me out too much. It seems really stressful. I read that Wikipedia page. I know what happens. I feel like that's a good call.
That was a book I read years and years ago. And I suddenly read someone had called it contemporary Gothic. And it hadn't struck me as that before, because I always thought, Gothic, you don't really get contemporary Gothic, do you? And I reread it again just when I was writing this, and I thought, that's fantastic. And again, Ian Banks's narrator, Frank, has a lot in common with my narrator, Niff. So, that was obviously an inspiration.
Yeah. Do you think of Watershower Refusum as Gothic? Was that specifically something that you were aiming for in the writing process?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think it is Gothic. I mean, it's been called various things. It's been called folk horror. It's been called literary thriller. But if you could just chuck Gothic in there as well and mix it all up, that suits me.
Yeah, it feels like a kind of interesting time to think about, like, folk traditions and, like, Englishness. Mm. And a book we loved this year was Lanny by Max Porter. And I don't know if you've read that, but it feels like they're both quite kind of interested in the, like, weird, dark side of, like, strange traditions and folk stuff.
Britain has a lot of that. I think as an island nation, we probably have more of that kind of thing going on than a lot of other countries. So, yeah.
I loved all the plague stuff in this as well. Mm. Some very interesting folklore as well as, folksy witchcraftery, but like real history of things that, the plague indubitably happened and the impact that had on real people's lives. And that was an element of this book I liked a lot.
And did your research into the historical aspect of Watershower Refusum, did that kind of steer the plot or did you find things to fit the plot that you already had?
I think it helped. I wanted Mally and his family to have a history in the village. And so the idea of having the plague cross there as a hook to bring that about and to explain that was, I think, it's probably a fortuitous discovery, actually.
And just for the benefit of anyone listening or here today who doesn't know what a plague cross is, would you mind just explaining that to us, please?
Yeah, so in the, throughout a lot of centuries from, say, the 15th century onwards, villages which were affected by the plague would put themselves into quarantine and they weren't able to trade with other people outside the village so as not to spread the plague. And so they would erect these plague crosses as a means to protect themselves, but also these little concave spaces around the base of the cross, which I mentioned in the section I just read, they would leave the money in there for the merchants to come and collect when they dropped off food and grain, food for the people and for the animals. And they thought that by filling these little concaves with vinegar, that would act as a disinfectant. Obviously, we know now that that doesn't work, but that's the history of the plague cross.
Worth a punt, anyway.
Yeah, can't hurt. So did your village have a plague cross? Did a local village have a plague cross? How did you know? I'd never heard of it.
I came across the idea of a plague cross. It was the summer, a few summers ago, when Pokemon Go was a big thing. And I don't know if you know, with Pokemon Go, the idea is that you go around collecting weapons and potions and things, and you always have a landmark which is associated with where you can go and collect these. And we were driving through Hereford one day, and it was my kids who are into this, not me, OK?
This is a safe space
so we get that out there. But it flashed up on my phone that there was one of these landmarks. It gives you a little bit of history, and it said Plague Cross. And I thought, that's amazing. That's like a red rag to a bull. So, of course, as soon as I got home, I got on the internet and researched it. And I can't find any other reference to this being a plague cross. There's no mention of it anywhere other than on Pokemon Go.
That's honestly the last thing I expected you to say.
I should have all these literary reasons, but I'm sorry.
I also imagine you slamming the brakes and just...
Yeah, I feel like at least... I think it's always better that you do not have, like, literary or somehow more elevated reasons for knowing about these things, because it means that, like, this could happen to anyone and anyone could discover this cool thing that, like, completely opens up, like, what they're writing about or what they're interested in. And, you know, email from your mum, Pokemon Go, like, that's amazing. Like, they're such, like, random gifts from the universe.
And then they all kind of coalesce and you just cherry-pick what you want from your own experiences. And I think that's a really good way to write a novel.
So we kind of touched upon folk horror. And quite often folk horror, particularly kind of pop culture examples like The Wicker Man, Midsommar, focuses on kind of community versus outsiders. Mm-hmm. That's a big theme in this book. Where did that come from for you?
I think for me it comes from, as I said, my family and I moved to this tiny little village from London when I was two. And we didn't go to the chapel. We lived next door to the chapel. But my sister and I grew up speaking Welsh. We went to the local school, so we integrated. But there was always a little sense that we were the outsiders. We were kind of possibly a little bit posh, you know, because my parents read The Guardian and we said lunch instead of dinner and things like that, you know. So there was all, we were always slightly set apart. And even though... I went through secondary school speaking Welsh and have always, I feel like I'm Welsh. We never quite completely 100% belong. So I think there's a bit of that that's made its way into my book.
Because it's not so much fear of the outsider, it's more like rejection of.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's not like they're trying to change anything. It's just the mere fact that the family is there and that's a challenge.
I think, it's an insular community and they have their ways of doing things. And like in The Wicker Man, they don't want the policeman coming along and...
Poking around,
yeah.
So how... I'm always, like, nerdishly interested when I talk to authors about how they write. So how did you write this book? How long did it take you to write this book? Literally, how did you write it in time... chunks and...
Like I said, it was written as the dissertation for my MA, which was part-time over 3 years. So I spent the first 2 years writing, scrapping it, chucking 10,000 words at a time, going back to it, just writing myself round in circles. And by the time I started my third year and had to really knuckle down because I had to have something to submit... I said, right, I'm going to start again from scratch. I'm going to write 75,000 words, whatever it is, in the next 9 months. And I did that, but because I'd spent the previous 2 years working on it, I had the characters, I had, you know, the idea of the locations. I didn't know where the plot was going to go, but I had a lot of the kind of compost that you need in order to write a novel. So, it was really a year... or 9-10 months to write what's in here. And that was done pretty much by just forcing myself to sit down at the laptop, writing in big chunks. I'm not one of these people who can go and sit in a cafe and work away. I need quiet to my own desk, a little bit superstitious like that.
But, like it's a job, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's treating it like a job.
Yeah, and to what extent is what we see before us in the form of this book similar or different to what you started out with?
In terms of when I very first started, it's completely different. When I first started, NIF was 12 rather than 16, and that proved very difficult to write because it would have been more of a YA book.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to write horror from a young child's perspective. And then in another rewrite, she became 14. But again, I didn't really feel comfortable with that. So then together with my supervisor, we decided that she'd be 16. And that just seemed to make it flow a lot better. Yeah.
So that was like the decision that kind of unlocked?
I think so, yes. The final draft. Yeah. And then it was so much easier to write that last 9 or 10 months of writing. It was a slog, but at least I knew what my character was doing.
It's really interesting because Nif feels like, I mean, she is such a well-rounded character, but it's hard to imagine the book starting as a spark with someone not quite the same as she is now.
Yeah. No, that is interesting. I think I just went down a few blind alleys and wrote myself into corners and took 2 years getting out of it. But, yeah.
And even, like, for purely practical reasons, there are kind of things that you just wouldn't feel comfortable doing to a 12-year-old,
exactly,
even if it's
a
12-year-old that you've made up in your brain, than to a 16-year-old.
Yeah.
It's kind of not that different in lots of ways, but then in others it's... Yeah, so it would be a really different book if it was about a 12-year-old.
So,
I'm very happy that it turned out exactly as it did for our reading pleasure.
Is there any advice you'd give to a writer in a similar position?
I don't know if I'm really in a position to give advice.
Of course you are, Leigh. You've got a book in foils.
I think I'd say be conscious of what genre you're writing in. Maybe try and do something different with it. So that whether you're writing, you know, horror or romance, thriller, crime, have a bit of a quirk to it so that when you approach a publisher or an agent, your book stands out as being different to what else is out there. So,
and don't be scared of throwing away 10,000 words at a time.
You've still got it. You've still got it saved somewhere, but if it's not working, then just scrap it.
Let it go.
And
you are working on something new for Dead Ink?
I don't know if it's for Dead Ink.
You're
could possibly
on
be
new for someone.
Not for anyone. For me.
Yourself.
Yeah, I haven't actually been contracted to anything. But yes, I'm working on another novel. This time set in the 1980s. So you can see where this is going. And I've also been working on some short stories, so hoping ultimately to have a short story collection as well.
It's like music to my ears.
Do you find that having been published... Do you find that having been published once has that impacted your writing in any way? Has it given you, like, confidence in your writing that you maybe didn't have before? Or how?
I think it probably has. I mean, yes, you know... Once to have a book published, it's proven that you can do it.
Yeah. So even if just to yourself.
Exactly, yes. So I'd be naive if I said it didn't give me more confidence. Yeah.
Okay, so do you have any more questions before we move
on? I don't, and I feel like now is a good time.
We always end the pod on one question, which I'm gonna ask you now. What are you reading
right now? Gosh. I'm currently reading The Furies by Katie Lowe.
Witchy.
Yeah. Witchy. It might be... It's very overdone these days, isn't it?
Too many witches around. No, we love it.
And I've also started on Convenience Store Woman, which I'm not very far through, but
certified
I love it.
Certified banger.
Yeah, we love that. We really love that.
And Salt Slow, Julia Armfield's collection.
Love it.
Who you're talking to only this week?
Yeah, on Thursday. Plug.
What a dream. Cool.
All right. We're going to give you 30 seconds to have a little shifty in your chair, talk to your neighbour about all the fascinating things you've just learnt, and think of your questions for the Q&A.
Do not put your hand in the air for 30 seconds. I'm timing you. Okay. I'll tell you when it's good to go.
We have microphones on.
So. I know.
Feeling good?
You were very kind.
Okay. Oh, I think my microphone's turned off. Hello? Can you hear me?
We're good.
So your 30 seconds is up. Lucy is going to take a picture of you for her record.
Can I have a wave?
Look happy. Look like you're... Yeah.
There you go. Thank you.
Thank you. So we would love to have your questions. I've heard on the grapevine there's a microphone, which would make sense because we are recording a podcast and you are not all mic'd. So who would like to kick us off? Let's start, Christina.
Hello.
Hi, Christina.
Hiya. As someone from Liverpool, I'm really impressed that you chose Dead Ink because they're a publisher that I know a lot about, and I think they're doing really, really good work. But I'm intrigued as to what actually attracted you to them in the first place, and also what the process was in getting published by them.
Okay, yeah.
That's so cool. I will just quickly rephrase for the benefit of the listeners at home in case something has gone wrong somehow. Christina just asked the question, which is, Dead Ink are well known to her as someone from Liverpool. How did Lucy find being published by them, and how did Lucy approach getting published by Dead Ink?
I mentioned that I wrote the book as part of my MA, and also as part of the same MA, I wrote an essay on independent publishers and why they're a good fit for debut writers. So I was very open to independent publishers already. And I had my eye on Dead Ink because I liked the way they approached things and previous books they'd published. And so when I saw that they were accepting submissions, I basically jumped at the chance. As we're taught to do, sent them first three chapters, a synopsis and a covering letter. And I was very lucky that Nathan, who runs Dead Ink, obviously must have had a very slow day that day, because he read my submission straight away and got back to me the same day and said, can I have the full manuscript, which I sent him. And it was only a matter of days, and he said, yeah, let's do this. So that for me was, you know, phenomenal. What else was the question? I'm sorry. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's great. Cheers.
Okay. There was another one at the back, or we can... Okay, let's stay at the back and then come to the front. I know you're there.
Hi. Hi, Lucy, Bethany and Alice. Kind of a question for all of you about horror as a genre. I feel like it's the genre that overpromises the most often and underdelivers the most, okay. Not in your case. But how did you find that balance between scary skull on fence and then at the end not going so gratuitous that you've spent 90% of a novel, or 99% sometimes, building up something and then you're like, oh... Do you know what I mean by that? That kind of like energy drop when the thing happens, when the reveal occurs. So a craft question for you, and maybe given you spoke about horror as a genre and Wikipediaing scary things, you could all three speak to that.
So the question was about balancing the way that horror is often building a really cool idea and then unable to deliver on that by the end, and the way that feels as a reader, but also how you manage to avert that crisis as an author.
I think for me it's about subtlety. It's about not showing all your cards to the reader, not laying everything about. It's layering. It's about building up suspense layer by layer and peaks and troughs. So... it's difficult to describe. It's just something that you do. And I always try not to be too equivocal about something. What I was really trying to do with this book was to not have any pigeonholes to put people in. No one is specifically bad and no one is specifically good. Everyone's kind of on a spectrum. So I think in horror that's interesting, because it's very easy to have a dichotomy of good and bad. But that's what I was trying to avoid.
Yeah, I always feel, for me, horror is about leaving you feeling uncomfortable. It's something that creeps under your skin and stays with you. So it's less about building tension, but maintaining that atmosphere of unease, that unheimlich.
Yeah, like the Shirley Jackson comparison in the blurb, I feel. I'm sure there are lots of people that wouldn't see that as, like, horror, but... I think
horror is such a wide genre. Yeah. You have the, like you say, the unheimlich, the uncanny, creeping sense of unease, which is what I'm more drawn to.
Yeah, that's what we want. Mm-hmm.
And then you can have your schlock horror with your, you know, zombies and vampires.
Which I'm also here for.
Yeah. Yeah, so each to their own. Yeah.
Alex, when the microphone comes your way, would you like to ask a question?
Hiya. I was really interested by the way you said that your character started off as 12 and then you wrote her as 14 and then finally at 16. Did those earlier, younger versions of her sort of stay in her past? Was she always that 12-year-old and that? Did she sort of grow up? And do you feel like that allowed you to make like a more rounded character by having this kind of experience of her at a younger age?
So did the previous iterations of Nif affect who she became as a teenage narrator?
That's a very good question, but it's difficult to answer because the book didn't progress enough with her in her younger forms for the plot to really develop. This is what I was struggling with, to have a plot for a horror story or a ghost story as it started out that allows the development of a child of that age. I found it very difficult. I think that's why I was stumbling around all over the place with it. So it was only really when she became 16 that it slotted into place.
While people are maybe ruminating on a next question to ask, I just want to ask, I love a ghost story. And what was your kind of original plan for this with ghosts?
The original plan was that it had a lot more to do with Petra, Nif's younger sister, who's accidentally drowned. And it was going to be a haunted house story. They come to this village in on the borders with Wales, and there is in the book still a sense of Petra's presence.
Yeah.
But is that in the mind of the mother or not? So that's still in there, but that was going to be the primary focus. And in the writing of it, that's kind of taken a secondary position.
God, that'd be such a different book.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yes, person.
We'll go here and then we'll go over this side.
Hello. I'm just wondering, given the extent of rewriting that you had to do and the need to adhere to a sort of conventions and peaks and troughs you mentioned as well, to what extent did you plot the novel? And when you started the sort of book as it is now, did you know roughly what the ending was going to be or where you needed to be by the end of it?
So the question was about, was the novel fairly plotted out when you started writing it, or did you see where it took you when you began it in the iteration that it's ended up now?
And the answer is no. I had no idea whatsoever. I just ran at it. I had this idea for a book. I had a deadline, so I just went for it. And I think with a second book, I am trying to outline it and plot it out beforehand, but I'm actually, even though it was really arduous and painful and time-consuming writing this because I haven't plotted it, I actually think it's a better book because of it, because it does have those character quirks in it that don't necessarily come about if you're writing to a preordained plot. So, yeah.
Deadlines are powerful that way.
Absolutely.
Was there a question? There is a microphone coming your way.
I was just going to ask, I'm really interested in by the fact that you wrote it, your book as part of an MA. I don't know if it's just because I'm paying attention now, but it feels like there are a few contemporary writers who've done the same thing. And I'm just wondering how much you think doing the MA impacted on the final product, and also if you think that it's worth doing because I don't know if it's worth doing for me personally.
So did your MA, how much did your MA influence the final product of the book? And do you think it was worth it?
Maybe you can then answer after. I'm always interested in what you have to say. So
For me, it was very worthwhile. It's not for everyone. I think with an MA, you take out what you put in. So if you're there to get a few more letters after your name, it's probably not worth it. If you're there to improve as a writer, then for me it was vital. And I think one of the most valuable things I drew from it was how to read critically. So not necessarily just the writing part, but how to approach a book and draw from it, actually use it as a resource for making your own writing better. And also, like we said, deadlines. Yeah.
Handy.
Yeah, I would say
you did a...
I did an MA in creative writing. And I feel, having a whole year to dedicate to your craft is an absolute privilege. It's not a privilege that everyone can afford for either time or monetary reasons. But if you can, why not?
What a dream.
What a dream.
Lilith, did you have a question? Could we have... Yes, thank you.
I think maybe we'll do two more questions.
Yeah.
I was really interested in the link you made between this novel and The Wasp Factory.
Yeah.
So what kind of struck me about that is that those are two novels set in regional isolated communities, and that's something that traditionally lends itself to the Gothic genre very well. And I know that there's lots of kind of critical theories to do with national identity, etc., about why that might be, but I was interested as to what your theory is, if you have one, about what the link between the Gothic and a rural regional space might be.
So yeah, very nutshell of that, yeah. Very good, cool question was, can Lucy theorise on why there is such a strong link between rural regional communities and the Gothic?
I don't have a theory, but I'm about to come up with one.
You're among friends.
I think there's something to do with the isolation. There's, mostly in my book, I'm quite keen, there's very little influence from the outside world. And that's another reason for it being set in 1976. There's no internet, no mobile phones. I think it is that being far away from the hub of London, say, and the influences that come from that. Any ideas to add to that?
I feel like it might... For me, it's kind of simultaneously the lack of oversight from traditional structures that protect us or make your life feel normal while having the extreme oversight of whatever community you're in and the tension of being like under scrutiny all the time but without the actual structures of
so the kind of macro
and
isn't so important, but the micro scrutiny that comes from the immediate environment.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Oh, your brain.
My mind.
So we'll do...
No theory. cool, so there are two people with their hands up, the exact number that we wanted. So, yeah, should we go for you? Because the microphone is right there, and then we will finish on you.
Okay, just wondering if you've fantasised about this becoming a film, which is what I can definitely see it as being, and if you had, who you might have in your cast list...
Casting for the
that's
future.
That's a difficult one and not something I've given any thought to, honest.
Sure.
Well, when I was writing it, I had in mind for Niff a young Tilda Swinton. I think she's a fabulous actor, and physically, that's who I had in mind when I was writing it. Linda, even though Linda's tall, I'd love to go for Gillian Anderson. She's a fantastic actor again. We'd have to maybe CGI her to make her a bit taller. And for Clive, I'd probably say someone like Ralph Spall.
Yeah.
So again, a really solid British actor. Can you see that?
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and Mally.
Yeah.
Dexter Fletcher, but when he was in Press Gang. Yeah.
I don't know any of those words.
Before your time.
Final question.
Can't top that question. My brother was born in 76, and when I knew I was coming here, I asked my mother what that summer was like. I was six, and she said oppressive, and she said there was an absence of things because you didn't have the energy to do anything, so you were really, really frustrated, and it made you angry. And I just wondered whether you saw the heatwave whether you ever envisaged it as a character in its own right. And if so, you know, how do you go about picturing that as a non-human character? How do you write the heatwave?
That's a really good question.
I haven't read the book yet. Spoiler alert. So.
I think it comes down a lot to the landscape. The landscape is so important. Like you say, the heatwave's a character, but that affects the landscape and the locations. So it's, you know, it's just the state of things, there's no grass, there's nothing for the animals to eat. The water in the river is very, very low. It's an absence, and that, I think, characterises this elusive character of the landscape. Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay.
Well, that's it.
Let's call time.
Yeah.
Before we have our applause...
Which we know will
which
be
I'm
having.
Fully expecting. We just want to say, first of all, thank you. Thank you to everyone here for tolerating us as per and joining us today. And thank you so much to Foyles and Dead Ink for inviting us along. But mainly, thank you so much to Lucy, who will be signing books shortly. But Lucy, thank you.